With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome along to episode 2 of Le French Rugby Podcast with me, Tim Groves, ex-Scotland international Johnny Beattie and former France international Benjamin Kayser. And we also have a very special guest coming on shortly. But first of all, let's find out how your week's been, guys. Because last week, Benjamin, the wife and kids were at the hotel. You had the builders in. Are they still there or has the hole in the roof been fixed?
Full on building site right now, but I actually left for Oxford for a couple of days, so I was fine. I didn't have any issues with the builders. I didn't have any issues with only having one functional toilet being used by 10 builders on a daily basis. Does not really fit with the criteria of hygiene for my wife and young children. But, you know, I was all right in Oxford. It was okay.
And Johnny, you were working for TV at the weekend, weren't you, on the Clermont-Toulouse game?
Yep, I managed to get away from my family on Sunday. So I got up to Paris and did the Clermont-Toulouse game, which was unbelievable. Crazy game and lots to talk about. I'm sure we'll get into it later, but it was a great game to cover.
Surely one of the tries of recent years, that game, the flick between the legs from Thomas Ramos.
Unbelievable. And again, especially to do it away from home in that kind of environment, it was crazy. So I think an early contender already for try of the season. Antoine Dupont again getting on the end of it, finishing off.
And we might get onto a bit more about the game later on, but Joe Tacori and Richie Arnold both got red cards. Are you expecting them to be banned for the Champions Cup quarterfinals?
Yeah. I mean, in severity, nothing compared to Owen Farrell that we saw in the Premiership. I don't think it's going to be as lengthy a ban. Well, we thought it'd be lengthy. He's only got 5 weeks. But I think, you know, for Joe and Big Richie, if they get 1 week or 2 weeks, that they're missing that quarterfinal. So a hard one on Richie because he's going up for a big tackle. He's a huge man and basically just doesn't dip, manages to get shoulder to head. Joe's maybe a bit more silly, reacting, elbowing Fritz Lee in the head. And I think that one might get more.
And there's a few other bits of news floating around the top 14 at the moment. Curtly Beale apparently has asked to have his own salary cut in line with some of his teammates. Have you heard about that, Benjamin?
Maybe he wants to pay a few rounds to the boys and stuff. It's a great example. You want to lead with example and stuff and try to show how well you want to contribute to the team. That's awesome. I think what Johnny said is spot on about the unfortunate, not very severe acts, but then that obviously will have a consequence too. That game was just mental. And remember last week I was telling you that you had to be careful with Clermont had some good signings. I really believe they're going to bounce back. And I'm a huge Clermont fan. Obviously, my heart is there. But what really pissed me off is to see how dominant they were and actually how close the game was. I think psychologically, it's definitely a win for Toulouse. And I just feel those old demons of not being able to seal the deal and to control a dominant sort of tempo, obviously rising back up. So that was a bit disappointing. And Kurnabil, yeah, fair play. The best way to come into a team is to pay a few rounds or to take a pay cut. You know, he's a smart guy.
I'm guessing neither of you have walked into a dressing room and said, hey, I'll take 25% less.
Luckily, we both retired before COVID, so we never had to decide. But, you know, if it were to happen, hypothetically, I'm sure we both would now, Benji. No.
To be totally fair, when you've done a few clubs and stuff, and I'm genuinely not being funny, if you're gonna play in an unbelievable club and you're gonna tell me, I don't know, who's the best player, but if you tell me Juan Hernandez in 2007 needs to stay, but we need 20 grand, whatever, I would have given him a little bit. You know, it's one of them, like, keep a player, give a little bit of me, because it's such a team sport that we need to shine with others. Is somebody to keep it with you? Yeah, I would have. But as soon as I walk in, or that maybe it's Kurnabil is on an outrageously big money, but otherwise, no.
That's the good news, but a bit of bad news as well over the weekend. Anthony Bello did his cruciate in the Toulon game. How big a blow is that to them? Because you said last week, Johnny, that you thought they'd struggle already this season.
Yeah, it was a really scrap. I know we'll get into the games later, but it was a real scrap fest. I think it was 29 or even more penalties in that game, a real typical first round game. And again, sad for him, real talent, really talented young guy, again, under 20s world champion with France. So another one for the future, he's already capped. They've got Louis Carbonell, who can fill in and play 10 as well. He's great, so that'll be, you'll have to step up to the plate. But I think now, you know, obviously they've got Estebeth out injured as well. He did his ribs and went off for an HIA. He'll be gone for a few weeks. They're going to have to go out and get a medical joker quickly and get somebody in to help, you know, build some rhythm and get them winning. Because obviously that first loss will sting. And he's not an easy guy to replace. He's hugely talented. So not good news for Toulon. And they're going to have to do something to replace him fairly quickly, I would say.
Well, speaking of Toulon, it's about time we got our special guest on, isn't it? And we've got a big one for you this week. Former European Player of the Year, Toulon legend and England international Stefan Armitage joins us. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We could see the sun glaring through the windows before. So you're obviously loving life in France. Whereabouts are you? How are you settling into Biarritz?
Loving it. We're just outside Biarritz at the moment. We're like 20 minutes from the town centre. I'm living by the beach and, you know, just enjoying the sunshine, trying to learn how to surf as well. So everything's going well.
And so how have you been settling in, mate, in terms of the club and the boys, getting to know everybody? Has it been a good start?
Yeah, it's definitely quite tough to begin with. It's just like going to school again for the first time, you know. When you're backpacking, rocking there, you don't really know what you're doing or who you're meant to talk to, where you're meant to sit. So I was a little bit nervous for the first hour, but then the boys were so welcoming.
And it was a good win at the weekend to kick off with as well. But you're obviously in the thick of it. Yellow card on your debut.
Oh, yeah, well, I've had better yellow cards, if that's a thing to say.
Go and talk us through it.
I didn't touch him. He fell into me, so I don't know. That's my excuse. Anyway, I put my hands up. It's my excuse. He fell into me.
Are you trying to say that French refs are now absolutely on the ball every single time? I can't believe you could even start with something that's so offensive, mate. Come on. Especially second division. I mean, it's rock and roll, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's different. Let's put it that way. I've told quite a lot of people, you haven't played French rugby till you've played in Pro D2. And you can see on the weekends when by the way referees are, just the way the rules are different, it's special.
Let's go back to the start then. So you're in Biarritz now, but obviously you started your pro career in England, but you were born in Trinidad and you grew up playing in Nice for a little while when you were very young as well. So just talk to us about your early days being born in the Caribbean and then growing up in the south of France.
So growing up, we were only in Trinidad till the age of six. And by then we were playing cricket, never heard of rugby before. We were all about Brian Lara. So my dad moved us over to England for his work. And he took us to see our first game of rugby, which was Richmond against Northampton when they were in the Premiership. And it looked kind of fun, looked a bit scary because I was tiny. My brothers were as well, like we weren't the biggest guys. And just seeing people smack each other, it was different. But then my mum got the good idea to say, instead of smashing each other up at home, why don't you go try and do it somewhere else? So we said, why not? And since that day, I've loved it.
And so talk to us about London Irish then coming through there. Because, I mean, their academy's been crazy good, isn't it? There's players everywhere at the moment that graduated through that academy.
Yeah, I think we've had, like, all through the academy, London Irish, and the coaches we had have been... They've looked after us really well. Having Toby Booth, Neil Hatley, all those boys around me, it was just great. And you could tell by all the boys who've gone on to Bath, for example, Anthony Watson, JJ Banahan, you know, the name goes on. Matt Garvey, Tom Homer, the name goes on. And it's not just at Bath, it's all over the country. It just shows how well they looked after you. And we were a massive family at London Irish.
Obviously, we want to talk to you mainly about your time in France, but you were capped five times by England and things were going well. And then you move over to Toulon. So just talk to us about the motivation behind your moving to France originally, because you've been there for a long time now. And was it a frustration with not getting into the England side when you thought you should be? Was that a big part of it?
I think it it was a bit of everything. Like, so we went on tour to Australia with England. And And it was tough. Martin Johnson clearly said I wasn't good enough. I needed to go away and improve. And for me wanting to improve, I had to go and push myself, because I felt, in a way, when I was at London Irish, most weekends, in my head, I thought I was going to be in the team, and I needed that extra step to make me become a better player. And I got an offer to go to Toulon, and it was Philippe Saint-André, and he said, listen, you could come out, you're going to be fourth choice. And I wanted to prove to not only myself, but to prove to everyone that I was good enough and to get over there and push for a starting place in Toulon. So I took the hard step. We gave up everything, me and my wife, and we moved over. And I'm glad we did, because it made me the player I am today.
And is it true you were told back then, when you were taking on that England tour, that you were going to be the kind of frontline flanker, and then they just parachuted Lewis Moody back in?
Yeah, that was hard. It was hard to, because we got down to Australia and it was like, they were like, okay, you're going to start the first test. So everything was going good, like training went well. And then all of a sudden, like, I got called in. It was like, we needed Lewis Moody's experience. So, well, I was like, so how am I meant to get? I'm meant to get experience, and it just stopped like that. So I thought I was going to be on the bench, and then they were like, well, we're going to put Joe Wesley on the bench because he could cover all three back rows. And I was like, okay, so I've gone from starting to not even playing at all. So it was definitely a shock, and it was it definitely made me want to try harder, try to go away and actually become a better player to give. And I always said from that day, I'm not going to give them any excuses not to pick me.
And so from there, obviously, you arrived at Toulon. Can you give us a bit of an insight? Because obviously things have changed massively over that time. When you arrived, in terms of an environment and the players you were with, from your expectations to what you got there and what you saw, what was it like?
Well, it was, for me, it was, an experience. I turn up, some of these guys I used to watch on TV, and I'll be like, you know, it's one of those guys you say you'll never play with. And I just sat in my corner. I didn't say anything for the first like couple of months, because I just wanted to keep my head down. Because they had superstars everywhere in every single position. And I think at that point, I knew already at that point, like, if Murad wanted to get rid of you, he'd get rid of you. So it's one of those, just keep your mouth shut and just listen and follow the other guys. So it's a daunting place to go to Toulon, because as you can see, how many players have come in who've gone through and not stayed very long and just gone on to a different club. So for me, it was just all about just getting there and just, and as I said before, it's just trying to give them no excuse not to play me and to train hard. It just came down to like training hard, pushing everyone else and learning off the best. I had like Joe, Vinnie Kirk, Chris Massoi, Juan Lobby, Jared Lab. I had all these players to learn from. So it kind of helped in a way, because it pushed everyone together. We had like a massive, there was no ego with anyone there, even though there were so many international caps. It's just one of those places that everyone tried to help everyone. We became a massive family straight away, I think.
And you mentioned him there, Murad Boudjelal. You're laughing already. So you obviously did stay. You stayed a long time. So he obviously liked you. But I mean, how did he woo you to start off with? And then how did that relationship develop with him? Were you close?
Funny story about that. Not really. Well, he is pretty much, if you're not South African, like you're not his number one. Or Johnny, you're not his number one. But funny story about Murad, because first of all, he didn't want me. I got picked by Philippe Saint-André. Because we did that Media Olympic, what year was it? It was in 2014. I got some award for Media Olympic, and so everything's gone through. They gave me a couple of prizes, and then Murad took the microphone at the end to give a speech, and his start of the speech was, Stefan Armitage, I never really wanted you. I wanted James Haskell. And I was like, whoa, everyone in the crowd was like, oh, thank you. This is meant to be like, you're meant to be saying well done to me, but you just like, okay, you wanted James Haskell. And it was just one of those things with Murad. He will say whatever's on his mind, and he doesn't mind who's in front of him. And that's the way he is. So I kind of tried to stay out of his way, to be honest, for the 6 years I was there.
All right, I've got to say something now because you guys are being way too nice. I mean, he's made 20,000 people week in, week out in Clermont have nightmares. Eh? Yeah. He's basically bursted my heart. But you are being humble because you said that you're almost like starstruck. But you were killing it. Eh? You rocked up in that Toulon team, and from the start, you guys were all killing it. It was a monster team that was in front of us because I was mainly on the receiving end. But I honestly hated you boys. I hated you boys for a long time just because the pain that you inflicted. But
feeling was mutual. Then,
absolutely. but then the reality is once you start knowing, like a guy like Fred Michelak that I know pretty well. Yeah. So when he tells you, for instance, you know how your brother for like a silly little reaction became sort of a hatred of French rugby and especially of Clermont, then if Fred Michelak tells me, listen, I'm telling you, off the field, he's a top dude, that means he's a top dude. That's all it means. Yeah. I do believe that the one of the reasons why that reaction was so harsh is because everybody was jealous of Toulon. You guys were smoking everyone. You know, you love to hate the ones who are good, basically.
Yeah.
You want to love the underdogs. Is it true that there was a sort of, you guys used almost Morad, like, let him do his little his show. Let him do his thing. Let him do his crazy press conference. At least nobody's bothering us. And you guys concentrate on having a big brotherhood and rocking it every Saturday. And then, you know, even the big boys would be like, you know, the example was he does a pilu-pilu every time you guys won big games in the change rooms. And even a guy like Johnny Wilkinson, who's probably like, the classiest dude you could find, would be like, just let him do his thing. Yeah, okay, he's done. All right, can you leave us now? Okay, good. And then he would actually talk.
Yeah, I think with that, especially with Murad, it's kind of, we knew he was always going to be there. Like, he was always going to be the changing room. So just keep him happy, let him do what he's got to do. And it's true, like no one else bothered us. So he takes all the thing, whether we're playing well or not, he will take everything. He'll go in front of the media, he will talk, he'll do all this stuff on social media and stuff like that. So in a way, it helped us to become a better team because we didn't have to worry about that. But it's true, like some of the guys, we would think, oh, is he going to go? Like, why is he still stood there? We want to kind of do our own thing with us, just the boys. He's just one of those guys, like you couldn't really say no to him because you don't know what reaction you're going to get. It's like you back a line up in the corner, you don't know what you're going to get. He's going to attack us somehow. So we'd rather just leave him to it.
And if he's always lurking like that in the change room, is he like that on nights out as well? Is he there like in the background thinking?
we've only actually had him like once on a night out, and he just actually was in Paris. It was in Paris after one of the finals, before he went to bed with both trophies. He just ended up buying a whole load of bottles for the boys, and then he took off and went to bed sleeping with both trophies. So it was... we don't really spend time with him, to be honest, which is good.
Is it also true that Morad once left you all in Oyonnax?
Oh, he wanted to. Well, so yeah, it wasn't our best game. And he told our team manager, he was like, cancel the plane. He was like, cancel the plane. I'm not paying for the plane to get home. And we're like, hold on, how are we going to get home? And it was like, you take the bus or the train. It's like, that's miles away. Catching a bus from Oyonnax or a train, we've got no tickets. We've just got all our stuff. So it's like, oh, so the team manager, so everyone like kind of stuck up to the team manager. I'm like, you can't do it. So we end up taking the flight back, and like all the team manager and the other guys, they got called into the office, and he was like, I don't want you guys at the club anymore. You guys could go. And that somehow got sorted out. I don't know how it got sorted out, but he was deadly serious about leaving us. And all, you know, it was snowing as well. It was cold. He is a special guy.
So, I mean, he was a special guy, but obviously as a coach for your time at Toulon, you had Bernard Laporte. So just talk to us a little bit about, I mean, obviously he's been a politician, he's been a national team coach, he's at Toulon. There were obviously rumours that Johnny led most things, Matt Gitto led most things, but just talk to us about Bernard Laporte and what he was like as a coach and as a man as well.
Well, okay. So Bernard as a coach, to me, still one of the scariest looking person I've met. Like a bald head, small glasses. He looks like one of those nutty professors. And I've always said it. And every time he gets mad, he gets like a red vein. He gets a red vein that pops out his head. It's just like the most freakish thing ever. But he wasn't, as a coach, he was quite good to us. So he always put it from the start. It's like, if you guys train hard, you play hard, like, listen, you guys could do whatever you want. But the moment that you guys don't perform on the weekend or you don't put your hand up, then we're going to have words. So most of the time that that drove everyone to actually to give their best every single time. He was quite hard on the Frenchies, on the French boys. He gave them a lot. Let's put it that way. He had a few crying boys every now and then at training, but for us, he wasn't too bad because maybe, I don't know, he just liked us more, I think, the foreigners.
just imagine the type of character that you needed to coach a squad like that, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he ever taught you anything in your tackling technique or even strategy in general. But like you said, he's the only guy you would never take the piss out of.
No,
he would walk into a room and he would scare the Bakis Bota to the Johnny and whatever. But imagine the quality of squad. Do you reckon any coach would rock up and explain to them how to do things? No, but you need to have a big set of balls enough basically to rock up and to actually, you know, keep them under control, considering Toulon is a hell of a place to actually live. And on top of that, you know, and it's an eccentric sort of town. So that's why the fit was just so good. You needed the crazy guy to be on top and to let the monsters in the middle sort of do their thing.
And I think, to be honest, and that's what he did most of the time. So he knew he put quite a lot in our places when we needed to. And like even coming in after doing a long bus trip from Clermont, I think we lost to you boys and that we took the
finally
bus.
the ones
and we took the bus back and we got back. I think we got back at like 4 o'clock in the morning and he was like meeting at 8. We were like, wait, we've just come off the bus. He goes, I don't care if you guys are not happy, you could go play for Kakaran, which is a team around the corner. We're like, whoa, this is okay. So everyone rocked up. It was like, oh, he just literally started pointing, your shit, just everyone. He goes, you guys should not be playing. And then like occasionally someone will start laughing and he'll be like, oh, if you want to go last, you could go play for La Seine or someone like that because they want you. I don't want you. It was like, whoa, okay. It's just, and then everyone, that's at the point when everyone just starts looking at the ground and like, oh my God, why do you rant for like, you just go for like half an hour saying how rubbish everyone is. Sometimes we needed it because it worked and the week after we won. So it worked most of the time.
I always remember when I was in the French team with Pascal Papé, and when they walked up into the tell me if it reminds you of Bernard Laporte, but we walked up into the team room, and he wasn't coach at the time, but he was just there hanging around, and he was there with the scrummaging coach. He's like, Pascal, come and push this fridge. I said, what are you talking about? Just push this fridge. And Pascal Papé starts, you know, just gives a little fridge a nudge to the fridge. He looks at the scrummaging coach. See? Feet not on the same line. That's why he shit Scrumminger and then just left the room. Those are the little mind games that he would play with you out of nowhere. You just come in to say hello, you know, and the guy's like, oh, just push a fridge. It's fine. Just push a fridge. And bang, and just abuse you with everyone and then would fuck off and do his own thing.
That is 100%. That's 100%. And he did it he did it with nearly everyone. Did it with Backis as well. Like, just like, well, I don't know. He said he was joking, but I don't think he was joking. Some of the things he would say to Backis, because then Backis would give him a look. It was like, oh, okay, maybe not. And then just like walk away. But yeah, he loves to take the piss out of the guys, and he'll give as good as he takes, to be honest.
You mentioned before that team that was so successful at that time, it was like a brotherhood. There was a close bond. Given that they were all such superstars, like, how was that bond forged? Was something done, or was it just naturally?
I think it was just naturally, because most of the guys came over and they wanted to show, because if you look at quite a lot of players, they came when it was coming near the end of their careers, what, a couple of years. So they, most of them wanted to prove to everyone that they still had it. So they were like going out, it was not like quite a lot of people saying we were mercenaries and stuff like that, but that's not at all what it was. We actually wanted to play and we came out and we gave everything like 100% every time. And it was just all about not letting down the guys. You look up to these guys. And that's the thing with Backis, who was like, I want to lead the way because I know there's thousands and thousands of kids who want to be in my position, who look up to me as me being their inspiration. So by me not going out there every single game, every single training session and giving 100%, it means I'm a letdown and I don't want to be a letdown. I've got kids, so I can't do that. And it's just the same. And that actually got passed on to everyone. So everyone was kind of the same thing. They're doing it for the guy next to you because you don't want to let those guys down. It was like when you take someone's place in the team, it was you've trained better than them. Maybe you played a better game than them. So if you train harder and you played a better game, you don't want to take their place and then not perform. Because that means you're letting down that guy who wants to play as well. So it's just kind of a thing where you're always pushing to be the best. And also having Murad in your back saying, I could bring someone else in if you don't perform. So that was always on everyone's mind anyway. So that was another factor that helped you push to us to gel quite quickly.
In spite of that pressure, though, that was on your shoulders, I remember speaking to Roy Lamont, who's out there with you as well, with Joe Van Niekerk, and he said, as a group, you had a good laugh. Like, you were also a good bunch of mates. As much as it was this pressure cooker, and when you arrived at Mayol, it was absolutely mental and a great place to play rugby. But those boys also explained, away from the pitch on like a Tuesday night, you also managed to go out, have a few beers, like Tuesday night club. You had a good group of friends and you had a good time together.
Yeah. Should I be saying this? Tuesday, and like that's when we first came out. They said Tuesday was like a, you know, it's like a casual day. You could have a couple of beers, day off on Wednesday. You just relax. And what do? There's not much. There weren't much around in Kakiran, so we're like, okay, we'll go have a couple of beers and just enjoy it. Like, and most of the time it'll be everyone. Like, everyone will turn up and we'll all be together. Like, when we're not training, we always try and do some things together, like barbecues, or we used to have like go-karting leagues and stuff like that. So it's like loads of different things that we actually did to make sure that we know each other well enough to be able to say like we're brothers, because some places, like some different clubs, it's kind of, you could tell that there's a divide in the team, and that's what we didn't want at Toulon. And we tried to do everything together.
And given Johnny's mentioned the Tuesday nightclub now, there's a couple of names around that time that were in that squad. They've retired now, so you can talk about them. We'll say that you had two beers and went home, but the likes of Martin Castrogiovanni, Drew Mitchell, there's a few others. Go on, talk to us. There must be some stories.
I'll tell you one. Like, one of my really good mates, Dean Schofield. So after we finished our finals, after we won the double, in Paris, we got the plane back, and they were setting up a parade where you take the boat, the bus, and you go to the mayor's office, and like you just celebrate. There was like 100,000 people in the streets. They closed everything, and we got back, and everyone was like, "Oh, we'll just go get change our t-shirt." But myself and Dean Schofield decided to go for one drink before we went home. And French people being French, like we won. So they started just giving us drinks after drinks. And then obviously not checking the time, looked up on the TV and I was like, Scoey, it's good that thing last year. It's awesome, isn't it? Like, and they're coming in on the boat. And I was like, yeah, that's awesome. And then he looks at me, he's like, why does it say live on the TV? I was like, oh my God, looked at the time. It's like, oh my God, we missed the bus, we missed the boat, and then missed the mayor's office. So we're like, oh my God, how are we going to get there? There's no taxis. And then we walked outside, and there's this, where we were, it's like in the Place de Toulon, where there was like 70,000 people waiting. We're like, oh, shit, what's going on here? And then the bus pulled up. We just literally just ran and just got behind everyone and then got on stage, and everyone was like, where the hell were you two? We're like, So we missed the whole thing. It was just, and apparently it was a great experience. I got videos there, so it's all right.
I want to step back. You were really humble a minute ago when you were talking about the awards that you won in 2014, and like, you were obviously European Player of the Year as well, which was insane. But at that time, you still weren't being picked up by England. What were the conversations that were going on behind the scenes that obviously we didn't get to see or didn't get to know about, in terms of the coaches you were talking with, the national setup with England? What was actually happening? How much dialogue was there back and forth with you and the English setup?
We had, one of them came out to see me. Was it Sher Lancaster? Sher Lancaster came out to see me in Toulon, and he came and he wanted to speak to myself and my brother together. So I knew it wasn't going to be like anything. If you want to speak to us together, it's because we're complete different players. We're not in the same position, or we're not in the same, not in the same place. So, and he just told me by then, like, I have to come back to England if I want to play. And he asked me, what did I think about it? And I pretty much told him, I feel like you guys told me to go away to become a better player. And I did that. And I still think I'm improving. I still think I've got a lot to learn. And by being out here, I'm getting better and better. Every training session, every time I play, I'm getting better. So why would you want to take that away? Why would you want to take that away from me? And So he just agreed and he just took off. He just went back. I didn't hear anything. And then I've got a phone call from like obviously the RFU, Bath and Toulon. They were organizing for me to go back to Bath for 6 months to play in Bath so I could be. And obviously when it comes down to that, then it comes down to money. But I wasn't involved with any of this. That's the thing. That's the funny thing about it. This was all happening between both managers of Bath and Toulon. So I didn't really have much of a say in anything that was going on. But at one point, my wife did pack my bags for me to leave to go to Bath. So
she was staying though. But you were off.
Yeah, she was staying. She's gonna pack up and just enjoy the sun and pack up the house. But I mean, it was just one of those. It's that I was never really involved. Everyone else was talking about it behind, like without me. They were trying to sort things out without me, like without me having a say. And it was just stressful. It was a stressful time. But listen, I've got no regrets. So
I can't believe, honestly, that top coaches would not take in consideration just your pure happiness. You were renowned in France because you were incredible over the ball. But you have to admit that in France, it's a national sport, the rucks, you know, so you can actually have a crack and have a go. So it fitted perfectly what you did. Then you had sort of the guys in Toulon that would do the other stuff for you, but they just told you, listen, make an absolute clusterfuck of all the rucks of the opposition. Obviously, what you were exceptionally good at, but there's also your happiness. Just like you said, you enjoyed the Tuesday night, you enjoyed the lifestyle, you enjoy the vibe around the team. I think it's incredibly reductive just to be like, right, well, you're doing this now we can just pick you up, drop you somewhere and expect you to do precisely the same thing, especially behind your back.
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
And to me, one of the main things as well is obviously like when we first came out to France, so my missus left her job and stuff like that to come out of it. And I couldn't, you know, I can't just do that again, just to pick up again and then move back on a like a hunch. Maybe I might play, maybe I might not. And as you said, like the lifestyle in France is different. We love it out here. Just the way how life is. It's not so rushed that you get in England. The training is not as, it's different, let's put it that way. You know it, being at Leicester, you know the difference. And they look after you here in France. Not saying they don't look after you in England, but I'm just saying it's different. Yeah, I just enjoyed my rugby here. And I was loving rugby because when I left England, I pretty much got to the point where I kind of fell out of love with rugby when I left London Irish. And coming over to France, just changed everything. I actually started loving rugby again. I loved going to training, just being in that thing, you being after training where you sit in the changing room and you're just chatting with the boys and stuff like that. You get that feeling. When you don't love it, you just want to get to training, you leave straight away, you wake up in the morning, you're sad. And that's what I was getting when I was London Irish my last year. And over here, it's just, yeah, I just loved it too much, I think, to actually really consider actually going back to England.
And can you see why that rule, obviously everyone knows why that rule is in place, but when you're kind of the center of that and all the headlines are around you, you're the most high profile example really of them trying to drag you almost back to England, like at that time, can you see why it's like that? Or are you so frustrated and you're thinking that this is a global game and players should be allowed to play abroad?
Yeah, I think it's a global game. Everyone should be allowed to play where you think, because quite a lot of people think straight away, oh, your first thing that you're going to France is because you're chasing the money. That's not at all what it is. Yeah, okay, there is a lot of money, but when I first moved over, I moved on the same money I was on London Irish. I moved there because of the challenge. They told me I was going to be number four. I was going to be number four, number seven. So that means I had to wait. I had to wait my time. But I was like, okay, that's a challenge for me. Do you mean, this is something you're lifting up. You're taking your whole life and you're moving across country, whether it works or not. So many players have come over and it's not worked out. And they've come back and they just hated it. Look at Gethin Jenkins. He was like my mate, and he was like one of the best props in the world. He came over and it just wasn't his thing. He played a few games, but it didn't suit him. Hence why he went back. But it's not just him. There's a lot of players that happen to, and we should be credited for actually taking a chance to actually come out there and fight for something. And like, I'm not the only one. Nick Abendanon as well. He's been outstanding at Clermont. He was outstanding for like 4 years straight. Every single game that he played, he was outstanding. But he was in the same position as me. So it's like we had a couple of conversations about it, and yeah, we both found it really hard. It was more frustrating than anything because we just thought, like, I was saying we were the best in that position, but everyone that they put in front of us who they thought was better in that position, we gave them a good game, or we were superior to them. So it was just frustrating to know that all the hard work you're doing, it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't pay off.
And you mentioned the conversation with Stuart Lancaster. First of all, did Eddie Jones ever get in touch after he became England coach? And then with that conversation with Stuart and with other coaches maybe, or people at the RFU, did they ever kind of take your point of view across the way that you're telling us now? And was there any kind of dialogue? Did they get what you were saying, or was it just the door's shut unless you're back in England?
Yeah, it was pretty much the shut. Like, they don't want to make any exception. And which, I mean, they said, like, you've made your bed, now sleep in it. So I was like, I will become a better, like, I, and as I said before, I tried to give them no excuse not to actually play me, not to pick me. And it's obviously they still had that one. So, but listen, it made me who I am now. And in a way, like, I kind of got to say thank you to them as well. Do you know what I mean? In a way, because it has helped me to become a better player.
I remember reading that you were quite close to actually changing allegiance. You'd obviously talked about having a huge affinity for France, the lifestyle here, the people. And at one point, there was reports, you know, Chris Massoy wanted to get back, play Pacific Islands rugby, Joe Rococo, and potentially you as well were looking at trying to play for the French team. Was that something that seriously crossed your mind? Were you exploring it at the time?
No, because, well, Bernard Laporte, obviously, he said, like, maybe I should, because you deserve to play international rugby. And at that point, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, do you know, one of those, after having a couple of drinks, yeah, why not? So we'd actually start the thing, because I wanted a French citizenship anyway, because obviously living in France and stuff like that. But and I looked back on everything, and it was like my greatest honour in rugby is having played for England with Dylan at Twickenham together for my first test. So by me going away and playing for a different country, that means nothing. So it was a thing that just went one in here and straight out the other. It was never a thing where, oh, this is going to happen, or we want this to happen. It was just like people gossiping about should he or should he not. I'm glad I didn't perceive that, because those five caps still means a lot to me.
And obviously, being at Toulon at that time, from an English perspective, everything was about Johnny. Obviously, it probably wasn't quite the same in France, but you mentioned it earlier on that he was the golden boy for Morad, for everyone. Was that great for the rest of the guys? Because the focus was all on Johnny. And what was it like sharing a dressing room with him? What was he like as a leader, bossing you around?
Oh, he was, I can't imagine, like, he said, I was watching him on TV, then I had a chance to play with him in England. And it's one of those guys in the changing room that you just, for the first like 10 minutes when you get in the changing room, you just stare at him. You don't know what you're staring at, but you're just staring at him, thinking like, oh, this is Johnny. It's like, he's my mate. He's my mate. How many people can say that? And it's just like seeing the way how he prepares himself, like, every single time, the routine he goes through to show everyone how actually professional he is and how he is just driven every single time. It's actually amazing. Like, his speech will actually get you up. It's like, whether sometimes when it's French and English, he gets a bit mixed up and you have a little giggle, but you know what he's saying. And like, he gets everyone fired up. And most of the time it's like, because everyone loved Johnny and everyone respected him so much. It's like every time we went out of the game is one of those, I don't want to let Johnny be angry at me. So I've got to play my best game. I know it's weird saying that, but it's Johnny. Come on, he kicked the drop goal for England to win the World Cup. So you've got to give it to him. Nah, he's a top bloke, and he's got a full backing of the whole team. And he's the one who led most of the training session in the backs, because what can you teach him? That is the thing. That's why I sit back now and say, what can you teach those players? Like, the players like Carl Heyman, Johnny, Beckies. And you were right when you were saying, like, to get a coach to come in and try and coach us. They were coaching us, those players. So Johnny was leading that.
You can't even teach him to tackle.
No, because he tackled
even that he does well.
He was teaching me how to kick though, so I find myself a good kicker now, so it's all right.
Johnny obviously had a special relationship with Matt Gitto when he was there as well. And was that kind of, obviously you spoke about Johnny leading everything, but I think Matt Gitto has spoken about it in the past about how it was perfect for him because Johnny did everything and Matt was the freedom. But I mean, in terms of being a forward with those two behind you, it must be the perfect situation.
Oh, it's brilliant, to be honest. And especially being at number eight as well, where I get to give them the ball most of the time. It's like Johnny is the safe guy, the guy who he will always make his tackle. He'll put the ball in the right position. And then you've got Gitter, who will just out of the blue just do something crazy. So having that relationship to know like how they work together, because they knew each other back to back, like they know each other how they play, and it's that's why most of the time like we controlled when they played together, it was frantic, but it was controlled frantic, if that makes sense. So we had Fred Michalak as well, who's a complete different player to both of them. The name goes on, like, by the way, 10 and 12.
You can see Benjamin's face.
Nah, man, I tell you, they're the only team who, already had all those guys, and they played us in 2015 Champions Cup final, and they only chuck in Juan Hernandez last minute as medical joker. I'm like, come on, that's just taking the piss. He was like, and he's a hell of a player who can play any position. He's honestly the best player I never played with Johnny and all that, but he's the best player that I've ever played with in 2007. When he first made it, and he was the best 15 in the world who every day said he wanted to play 10. Like, it made no sense to me, but he was by a mile the best player I've ever seen. He could, a bit like Johnny, could do anything and could smoke a guy in a tackle.
He's the most skillful player. Like, you see some of the things he does, the little chips, the little pass at the back. And sometimes I'll just look and I'll just watch him. I'm like, okay, oh, I need to catch up. Get to the rock. But that's what you used to get. Right? Even like Quaid Cooper as well. He came over. He didn't have the best time, but he came over and he performed. Nico Sanchez. Oh, it goes on. The names goes on. So there was a lot of 10. But Johnny is in my mind. He'll always be the best 10 I've played with, and one of the guys who drove Toulon to become the team we were back then.
Funny enough, you mentioned Hernandez, Nico Sanchez and stuff, but the salary cap is never one of the strongest assets, right? It's never like one of the biggest things.
We're all on 100 grand, that's it.
Exactly, with staying in top 14 bonuses of 200. I mean, fair play. You got to give it to him. Pujilal, he actually never, I don't know, but he almost never cheated. He just twisted the rule because it was a shit rule. He just, whenever you gave him a rule, he just found all the different tweaks. But who doesn't optimize their tax? Everybody does. Well, he just did it a million times better than everybody else.
Yeah, I can't say. I don't really know how he did or what he ever did. But to get the players he did, I think there's something about him. Whether you like him or not, it's like Marmite. Either you love it, you hate it. And he managed to get quite a lot of top players over there. Like, they got Joe Van Niekerk to come over there when they were in Pro D2, so that's saying something. And he was like not long after that, long before that, he was voted the player of the year, but that's the international player of the year. So it just tells you something of the what kind of person Murad is. And he did the best to get the best team he could to achieve what we did. So some place you've got to say, okay, fair play to him.
So I don't want to bring another downer on things, but you mentioned how when you came to the end of your time at London Irish, obviously you were not enjoying your rugby. And then I think you mentioned that towards the end of your time at Toulon, Morad was linked with the fact that you were not liking rugby at all. So just talk to us about how that kind of panned out and kind of what led to you moving and whether you got reinvigorated after that.
Yeah, well, it's the same. Like, I just started falling out. Quite a few players left, guys who drove the team. And for me, it just started getting to the same way where I felt like I'd achieved everything that I could at Toulon. So I wanted more. I'm a guy, I always want more. So for me, I thought the best thing is for me to move on and try and create history with someone else, because that's why, generally, that's why we play rugby. We want to leave a benchmark everywhere we go. So he kind of saw that, and he actually offered me 3 more years to stay. And I was like, I've got to be true to myself. And I always said, the moment I stop loving the sport that I love, that I've like trained all my life for, and I always said, like, if I fall out of love with it, I need to move on or stop. And I don't think I want to stop there, because I still knew I had a lot left in me. So the best option was to move, and I had a few offers to go a few places. Toulouse, Lyon, Montpellier, Clermont was one of them as well. But I didn't want to go to Clermont because there's only like only tires and the Michelin man. So apparently it's pretty dead there. So
see those little cliches that of when people don't know, it's fine, it's easy. We definitely did not have the same lifestyle as in Toulon. But even though we didn't show it, when we lost to Toulon, it's because we clearly got beaten by better. So there was, at the end of the day, it was always about respect. And I always feel that 2015 Champions Cup final in Twickenham, it's the first time in my life I got bullied. They weren't particularly better. They never created anything, but they're just tough fuckers. Well-deserved title. So it's not a problem. You could have come to Clermont, mate. I would have got a glass of wine for you. No problem.
Should have. But I decided to go to Pau. So with Carl Heyman told me to, he said, come with me. We're going to create something different. Like, they've got a new project. And I always wanted to go somewhere different. I knew all the Toulon boys went to Lyon. And it was, to me, it would just be me moving, same thing. Like, do you know what I mean? Toulon to Lyon, all the players there. So I wanted to separate myself and literally go to somewhere completely different where I could actually go start again and not be comfortable. I wanted it to be difficult, and Poe was that choice for me.
And you were there for a few years. So now you look back on it and you mention those offers that you had from Toulouse, Clermont, Lyon, and what those clubs have done in the past few years. Are there any regrets there at all, or are you happy with the decision you made?
Yeah, I'm happy with the decision. Definitely happy with the decision. So no regrets whatever I've done in my career, because we actually got from like Poe from being promoted from Poe to just about staying up in the top 14 the year after, and missing out by 1 point in my first 2 years. Do you know what I mean? It was something massive for the club, because they've never been that close to it. So I think we did have something good. We had a great bunch of players, not particularly big names, but a lot of players who had a lot of fight and who wanted to play rugby because they loved it. And that's why I enjoyed it, and I wouldn't have any regrets on it.
Obviously, you're now in Biarritz, but you were going to go over to America, to the sun and the sand of California, as opposed to the south of France. So that was going to be San Diego Legion. I think they've signed Chris Robshaw now.
Yeah, Chris Robshaw. Eddie Jones is going there as well, I think.
Yeah, as a consultant. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're in a good place now, but in terms of how that move kind of fell apart, is there any kind of ill feeling there at all, or are you just really happy to be at Biarritz?
No, not at all. And I've got loads of mates over there. Like, I got Martin on it to go over there. And do you know what I mean? It's something different. Maybe in a few years' time, when the league is a lot more accomplished, when it's better. But at the moment, I just feel it's like you don't know which way the league's going to go. You are getting like good players going over there, but I'm so glad the decision was to stay in France, because there you go, I'm finding the love of rugby again, and it's enjoyable.
And in terms of the project they've got going on, obviously you've come down, big name, Francis Saili as well, Henry Speight, you know, some big investment. What are the expectations from the board, from the president, Al DJ, who's come on board for this season? What are your hopes and what are you aiming for this year?
Well, he called me into the office. He's like, listen, there's only one outcome to this, and we're champions in top 14. Otherwise, you're gone. I was like, oh, what? Hold on, take that back. it's like, listen, we've got a 2-year project, and that's going to be us getting up to the top 14 new stadium, new facility and stuff like that. Obviously, there's stuff going on with planning and stuff like that, with him trying to get the permission and stuff like that. So I don't really know. I don't really know the ins and outs about it, but I know there's a massive, massive project to. They want Biarritz to become the Biarritz of 2000 and what was it, 2011? Is it before they went down? A team who's had all the names and they were an outstanding team. So that's what they want to bring back. They want to bring back a team that everyone's proud of and everyone wants to come and see because it's kind of fallen away lately in the past few years, and they just want it all to come back.
There could be a show written just on Biarritz Bayonne. It's the actually, it's everything that we want to chat about, honestly, in this thing, is all the myths and the buzz and the exoticism of French rugby. So there's a mix of ancestral rivalry between two sort of neighboring big villages. You can't even call them massive towns, you know, big villages that hate each other's guts. But they don't really hate each other's guts. It's still like rugby rivalry, you know? It's banter that you love. You love that derby and stuff, but they'll still be drinking piss together afterwards, you know? It's got nothing to do with it. But then you mentioned the whole project of Biarritz and stuff. I just read, it's just that, for me, that sums it up for you, that the mayor of Biarritz was forced to buy her own ticket to come to the game.
Yeah.
Because she's basically, they're being complicated with the planning permission to extend, not necessarily the stadium, but what do you do with everything's around? I don't know the bloke, Aldige, at all. But I think what he wants to do is create sort of an actual real economy behind to support the club, which I think is what every club should do instead of, you know, relying on massive sponsors. But then it's who gets the biggest share. Biarritz is a small place, yes, but property there is hot, you know, so you got to know what you're doing. And so to the point where he sacked a few sponsors, he hates the thing and it's politics and but she still comes to the game, but she makes sure that everybody knows that she paid for her own little ticket. You know, That's France for you. That's Biarritz for you.
Yeah, and I try and keep out of it because I get so many people like asking. So we got my neighbours, all of them are Bayern supporters. So they saw me move in and they were like, "Oh, so have you moved to play for Bayern?" I was like, "No." I was like, "Why?" He goes, "Oh, we're like a lifetime members of Bayern." I was like, "Oh, okay." Moved for Biarritz, and one of them just turned around and walked off. I was like, "Whoa, okay." And then all the others like, "Ah." But don't worry, next year you can move to Bayonne. But we don't like Biarritz. So I was like, "Oh, what's the problem? You guys is the same town anyway." And they looked to me like I was crazy.
Blasphemy.
And that's when I realized, don't ever say that ever again. So they're separate, and even though they're touching, they're separate.
And Stefan, hopefully you've got a bit more time left playing yet. But obviously, once you get to the kind of age that you're at now, everyone's looking at what they're going to do after rugby. So just give us an insight. Are the family settled in France? Are you going to stay there once you finish playing? And, you know, what are you going to do next? Do you want to stay involved in rugby or not?
Yeah, I think as much as quite a lot of people say, yeah, once I finish rugby, I just want to get out of it. I don't think I might say it, but I don't think I can. So there will always be a part of me who will get involved in rugby. I want to be a sports advisor for young French players, you know, just getting themselves set up and just getting on the right track, like kind of like a mental thing, like what to think about. Because quite a lot of young players nowadays, they think, oh, life in rugby will last for 10 years, 10, 15 years, when that's not the case. You could have guys who could be on a lot of money quickly and get injured and they're finished and then they don't actually know what they're doing. So then they go off and they have problems with depression, and don't want to say it, but that's why you get quite a lot of young kids committing suicide in rugby, in not just rugby, in every sport, because they haven't got someone to talk to. And that's the kind of thing I want to do. I want to be that middleman between the agents, their club and them, to help them to make just life a lot easier. And so I could just be there to talk, because I have been through quite a lot in rugby. I want to give back, and I think this is one of the best ways to do it, because I think quite a lot of players are just left on their own quite often, and that needs to stop.
And is that something that is a role that's already there in lots of French clubs or around France, or is that something that you think you'll have to kind of bang doors down and develop your own niche?
I think there is kind of, obviously we have Proval in France, but it's not the same, because Proval's looking after thousands and thousands of players. Sometimes that one kid just wants like an extra half an hour chat, and it's something like Proval sometimes can't do, because they've got so many people to actually look after as well. So it's all about just getting into it and just doing it, not having too many people, but just having the right amount where I could actually spend enough time to make sure that everything is covered. And by the time we finish that meeting, at least like everything is clear. I think that's something we're going to push forward. And I think there's quite a few guys who I've played with and who are quite keen to actually get involved with that. Because as I said before, I just think we need to give back as much as we can, because rugby has given us a hell of a lot, and we need to give it back.
That sounds really good. And thanks ever so much for joining us today, Stefan. Good luck with that post-career. But more importantly, first, you better win promotion from Pro de Deux. Otherwise, there's going to be some trouble by the sounds of it.
Yeah. Otherwise, I'm coming to work for you guys, if that's okay.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Stefan.
Cheers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Good guy, eh? And he'll be awesome in that pastoral role as well. If you can set about creating that, you'll do that really well.
Did you enjoy that as much as Johnny Benjamin? Some of those stories about the Clermont Toulon finals back in the day, you didn't look like you were enjoying it quite as much.
No, I wasn't really enjoying, you know, getting my face rubbed into into all those disappointments. But to be fair, that's what I said to him. I mean, I spent a long time hating their guts. He was never one of them. He's always been, to be his brother is a bit more of a difficult character. But I changed my mind with his brother as soon as, honestly, Frédéric Michel, I got really close to him. He's like, just dig a little bit deeper. And usually, we should actually have a chapter about this. Get a tough muller on this show and actually go through the guys that are just diagonally different. Mamuka Gorgodze, you played with him, Johnny?
Yep.
He's the meanest shit you could ever find. And he's a ginormous dude. But there's loads of them like that. Loads. Jamie Cudmore. I love nothing more than to play with him for 5 years. Top dude, always have my back, always protect me. But when I realize you play against him, just wants to hurt you all the time. And you feel that it's physical about them. Back his butter. Like I feel that he wants to eat my face alive.
He has single-handedly the world's strongest handshake.
Who, Bucky's?
Oh, he broke my hand. After a game, went in to have a beer, either in the change rooms, have a beer with them, or it was the post-match reception, sitting down and said, oh, good game. Crushed. And then everybody in our team, and I think it was Montpellier at the time, said the exact thing. Like, what is that guy trying to do to our hands? And we asked the Toulon boys, we asked Johnny, and they were like, it's everybody, it's not you guys, he just enjoys crushing people's hands. It's just what he does.
If you want to have a laugh, have a look at him on Instagram now. He weighs about 175 kgs. He is huge, and he's like all wearing all those hunting shirts. It looks like a tent. Like he's basically a walking tent.
But going back to your point about Toulon, you almost not love to hate them, but almost jealousy, because it was like playing for a club team that was a Barbarians team. Like, that team was the best of the best, and it was the best I think there ever was in clubland. I don't think you'll ever get that type of 15 or squad together again.
Nah, it's more than 15. Yeah, it was the squad.
Exactly, it was 40 of them.
Castro never played a game.
And then no matter what team you were playing against, you arrived at Mayol, super intimidating place. All those guys, they rocked out whatever bunch of rock stars it was, and you knew it was going to be on a huge game. So yeah, some place, great team, and Steph was a huge part of it. He was amazing. And again, he's super humble, like saying, oh, won some award. Like, he was European player of the year. He was insane and leading from the front. He was some player, and he still is. I watched him play in that game against Perpignan on last Thursday, I think it was, and he was unbelievable. Again, still 5 turnovers, killing it, ball carrying, distributing. One of the best jacklers we've ever seen in France. He's still top, top man. Top, top player as well.
Right, let's have a look at the weekend's action now in the top 14. 3 away wins. We spoke a bit about how strong French teams are at home. Is that at least partly to do with the lack of fans in the stadium at the moment or not?
I don't know what you think, Johnny, but I don't really. I was very surprised. I mean, I saw saw bits of the Lyon, what is it, Lyon Racing game. Lyon are one of the league favorites. Huh? They're one of the clubs that have got sort of the hype on them and the right path. And there was still a crowd. It wasn't a huge crowd, but there was still a crowd. And they just got beaten by a better side. Maybe it tames things down a little bit, probably. What I think is that nobody's played 80 minutes of full-on rugby. They played team one against team two, most club, because everything got cancelled. But you don't really go full-on because you don't want to kill your teammates. And they played because normally you play 40 minutes of a friendly game. So the teams that played a friendly game, each player played maximum 40 minutes. So you could tell they were all raggedy. What looks like it is the lineout. Just look at the lineouts. The lineouts of every single game were extremely poor. And that's just réglage, it's like the settings, you know, just getting to go through the phases, really.
I think there's different layers to it. So after doing that game up in Paris for Canal Plus, I had breakfast with François Tranduc. And he was just saying, look, from a psychology perspective, the first game of the year, he has always hated playing at home because nobody's prepared, nobody's ready. So it's good just to get away from home. There's no pressure and try and nick a result. And you add into that, you know, that's a psychology aspect for like French guys and anybody really. But you then add on that, look, nobody's prepared. Physically, nobody's in good condition. You saw the players, nobody's ready really. All the games have been cancelled. They've had some training games between themselves, but that's been it. So they're not prepared physically. Again, lineouts were shambles, discipline in every single game. You could tell people's heads weren't right. Like Toulon, La Rochelle, there was 30 penalties. Clermont against Toulouse, 2 red cards, a yellow card. Like, it was a bit of a shambles. So I think, I mean, but great for those teams to nick a result away from home. But I think, you know, as the weeks go on and things start to get refined and processes become better, you'll see that quality and the cream start to rise to the top again.
You mentioned the word shambles there, Johnny. Montpellier and Pau got the season underway on Friday night. The lights went out, didn't they?
Yeah. So I caught some of it on Canal, and they were joking that Moed Altrad had forgotten to pay the EDF bill, and that's why the lights had gone out. But again, they just, I don't know, it started with that. Then the ref had the worst man bun I've ever seen. It was comical to kick off the season with that game. And then Montpellier just strangely didn't get out of the blocks, looked really straight up and down, didn't look inventive. Scrum really struggled, really, really struggled. And ended up Trevor Brennan's son came off the bench to try and shore things up. That was his first game, I think, since the first game of last season. So again, another huge French potential talent coming through. But just they didn't get going. They could not get going. They had Timu and Camara, their back row, were on fire. They were amazing. But apart from that, they just kind of looked a bit turgid, a bit kind of stuck in their blocks and didn't manage to get going. So a huge result for Pau. That was the first time I think Montpellier had lost at home in 18 months, which shows how big a result that was. And for a team that really struggled last season in Pau, that's a huge result to get first game up, definitely.
And you mentioned a prop there in Daniel Brennan. One that wasn't on the pitch was Mohamed Hawass, and he's been in a bit of trouble this week. So, I mean, do we know anything around what that was about and what's happening to him?
So I've caught wind that potentially there was some sort of altercation between him and a coach. Potentially. So he's been disciplined. They've fined him. They've taken away his prime éthique, Benji. So the ethical part of your salary you get for being a good egg and abiding by the laws of the club. So that's been taken away from him for, I think, quite a few months. Also murmurs that they might be trying to get rid of him now, and that thinks he's a troublemaker. Also Guillaume, the big tight head as well, that was previously at Toulouse, Lyon, Oyonnax. Potentially looking at the two of them jumping ship and them trying to get somebody else in, because they've only really got Chile Chava as their first choice tight head, and after that looking a bit thin. So not a great start for Big Momo.
You tell me what you think, Johnny, but I don't think they'll get rid of him. unless what we don't know, it was really, really problematic what happened during the week. What might happen is that he might also get sanctioned from the FFR, because Fabien Galthié was very adamant about outstanding behaviors, you know, higher standards for internationals, zero tolerance policy, blah, 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 blah. And remember, he already punched a guy during the Six Nations in Scotland, a little bit out of nowhere. They obviously triggered it, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't a huge, you know, physical comeback that led to that. So he's already sort of walking on edge. He already had his joker, if you know what I mean. They already let him off the hook once. So I think that one he might pay for a while.
Do you remember he got in that punch up with Bismarck Duplessis as well? So with Bismarck Duplessis in the warm up before he got on the pitch, I think last season.
Yes, but everybody said that Bismarck deserved it. And the whole squad was sort of cheering. They were sort of cheering, go on, just go for it. No, everybody was pissed off because he didn't actually drop him completely. But that's a different story.
So not a great start for Philippe Saint-André. But also there's a bit of talk about Xavier Garbajosa's future as well, isn't there?
Little murmurs. Again, just things from people in around the club, a few things in press. But, you know, he's 2 years into a four-year contract. But then what Altrad has paid people out of contracts before, it's not something he's shy of. So, you know, obviously disappointing to start that first game and lose at home. And if it isn't turned around fairly quickly, you might be getting hauled into old Moed's office sooner rather than later.
And you mentioned Benjamin Rassing's win away at Lyon being a bit of a surprise. Any other results that stood out for you?
Well, Agen losing at home the first game, I think, to Castres. French rugby is, like Johnny said, is very tough for the first week leg, okay? But usually going in Agen is a tough old place. They had that winger that signed from Quinns, you know, Ibi Toye, I think that's what his name is. So they had some really solid signings. Camille Girondeau, number 8, that played with me, the big curly hair from Clermont. JM Butin, also from Clermont, but also from Lyon. Just, I thought they looked solid and good. And to lose at home when, you know, they were 300% commitment to it, because that's what they play. They play the home games. And again, to go back on the Clermont-Toulouse game, Toulouse put a strong team out. They put a strong team out. Clermont put obviously their best team out, but they had a few injuries during the week that weakened them, especially in the forwards. And there was a strong call to put Morgan Parra on the bench and to put Sébastien Bégier. That's going to be like the little story within the team for the whole year. And they started off really well. They were completely dominant and they were just killing it, to the point where Joe Tecori elbows a guy out of a silly reflex and gets a red. So you're thinking they're going to go through this. And then Toulouse, we're actually getting angry and angrier. This new rivalry that used to be Clermont-Toulon seems to be shifting a little bit to Clermont-Toulouse. And you could tell there was some real anger from Hugo Mola, even on the side. Don't know what you thought, Johnny, but I don't like his attitude. I don't like it at all, but I'm biased. But you could tell he was getting angry. It was very, very personal. And then gradually Toulouse did precisely what pisses me off, but they're very, very good at. Is they want to go out. Either they can get smashed or they just try something and usually it wins. If you know what I mean? They're very risky. They just take a chance, take a risk, and it paid off. And you know, there's nothing worse than when it's the two men down, you're 15 on 13 because they got a red card and a yellow, and then you can see the try. And then they get another red. You're like, oh, they're dead meat. And they put another try. They were actually ahead, like 8 minutes to go. They were ahead. George Morala decided to take everybody on his back and just like bump off a few guys and score, fair enough. But it's one of them. Imagine if you fast forward, you're in the change rooms. Clermont were like, yeah, great, we got the win. But boys, I mean, come on. Two red cards, two massive, and it's two big locks as well. So the physical power. We need to control this better. It's going to be a thought of, does Morgan Parra need to start now because he can control the games and busy come over? Huh? And then the other hand, in Toulouse, if I'm the coach, I'm like, boys, you guys stood up, two men down, you come back with a defensive bonus point. Well done. You know, it's almost like a win.
Yeah, I thought the game was mental. So completely dominant by Clermont in the first half. Toulouse did not look like they could be bothered, being completely honest, and then almost looked like it took the two red cards to get them fired up. But at the same time, if I'm in a team, any team that's coming to Clermont, and I lose my 2 second rows and I'm 15 against 13, I'm expecting to concede 60 points. And so what I was disappointed with was how Clermont really failed to take any control of the game. Cami Lopez, obviously one of your buddies, he got player of the week in Midi-Olympique for the first round. And I was like, how? Like individually, yes. But at the same time, you're 9 and 10 are meant to control the game. Toulouse should have lost that game by 60 points. But strangely, from that lack of control, coupled with a complete lack of discipline, they gave away something like 20 penalties again for stupid things. They gave away field position. And then they could not defend them all. It was the strangest thing. They competed for everything in the air. They had obviously had a numerical advantage. They were two men up, and Toulouse absolutely pumped them at Mall. So Clermont obviously now going to Bayonne next week. I know the coaches there, I know Yannick Brew, I know Joel Ray. I know that they will say, look, Clermont have really, really struggled to defend this Mall. We're going to attack them there. And it was, I've never seen that from Clermont at home, not defending a Mall like that and going back at the rate of knots they did against two men less. It was incredible. And again, the end of the game, Intermac has that try disallowed. It shouldn't be disallowed. I thought personally Toulouse should have won that game. A strange decision by the referee. But I also admired the decision by Intermac at the end. Instead of going for a draw and taking 2 points.
Yeah, they went for the win.
They hadn't won there, I think, you can correct me, something like 12 or 15 years, and they went to try and make some history. So really brave performance, really big fight, showed decent spirit, which we know is hugely important in France. And Toulouse will take great heart from it. It's obviously going to be difficult for them. We don't know if they're going to lose those two guys for Champions Cup and they have to back up in top 14 with limited resource in the second row. But hugely spirited performance. They can be really chuffed. Clermont will just be happy to take the 4 points and move on. Zap it, forget, and move on.
Let's have a very quick look ahead to round two now this weekend. A couple of the big games. Toulouse host La Rochelle, Racing host Montpellier. What are you looking forward to in particular?
Well, hopefully there's not going to be any postponed games. Firstly, we also had the vice president of the FFR come out and said, look, there's not going to be any cancellation of any games. It's just everything is going to be pushed back. So we now know there's going to be no games cancelled. But there's a lot of teams that now are in a trickier situation. There's teams that have had no games in the first round, haven't had any preparation. So teams like Bordeaux, for instance, at home to Brive, they need a win. They haven't played in 3 weeks. They haven't played any preparation, I don't think. It's going to be a tough gig. So they have to get on. If Christophe Urios is going to back up from last year with that Bordeaux side and lead this top 14 again, they have to win. Again, looking down the fixture list, you've obviously got Racing Metro, you've got Toulouse, and you've got Clermont have to then back up again the week after in Champions Cup. So squeaky bum time for them, again, playing a mixed bag, some of them at home, some away, and it's going to be difficult. They're going to have to shift their teams around and try and get home wins, especially for Racing and for Toulouse playing at home before they then have to back up and play in the Champions Cup the week after. So some tricky fixtures for them to get through.
Yeah, I think the big one is the Champions Cup though in the following week, exactly like you said. So what I'm looking forward to is obviously, like just like Johnny said, no postponed or no cancelled games. But what I'm looking forward to is the lineups. I want to see if the guys are actually going to go full on. What's the strategy of the coach is going to be? If you're the Racing coach, so you won in Lyon. Of course, they went for the win, but it's a great result for them. But then you're going to play Clermont in Champions Cup after. You can't afford to lose any players. Yes, but you can't afford to lose at home either. And Montpellier, who've lost at home, are going to get bollocked all week and are going to be fired up. So you know, it's all that thing is, do you concentrate on yourself or do you look at the others? I should have asked Steph on that. It was one of the things that Mathieu Bastaro, his absolute lookalike, basically told me, is that Toulon never ever bothered looking at opposition. He said to me, and it was almost like a mental thing. Like, we spend hours with Clermont trying to dissect, you know, and know who you've got in front of you. Maybe too much. And maybe it plays in the psychology to be like, oh, come on, can't we not just back ourselves? And apparently Ben Laporte was very good at it. He's like, don't bother looking at the others. Just be 100%. Nobody can touch us. And then even bother looking at anybody else. So that's the type of psychology I'm going to look at this week in the lineups. Toulouse, I've got La Rochelle did really well, I have to say, against Toulon. So they're going to be hot and then not playing Champions Cup quarters. So how are Toulouse going to do that one? No, it's a tough one.
And again, against what we saw in the first round, like I've marked down not everyone I think is going to win or lose. Like I've got Pau to win at home against Agen, Racing to back up and win again against Montpellier, Toulouse to win at home against La Rochelle, Bayonne to beat Clermont, Bordeaux to beat Brive, Cast to beat Stade Francais, and Toulon to beat Lyon. So I've got everybody this week. I'm backing everyone to win at home.
There you go. There's your accumulator. Everyone will be backing them now, Johnny. You agree with that, Benjamin?
Apart from Bayonne winning at home against Clermont, you've got it 100% right.
There you go. You heard it here first. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Benji. A massive thanks to Stefan as well. And thanks to all of you for listening. Don't forget to hit subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcasts on. Leave us a nice review as well. Check us out on YouTube, and we'll be back with another episode next week. Au revoir, guys.
See you soon, guys.
Ciao.